This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we just recently observed World No Tobacco Day. It's a global event launched by the World Health Organization to examine the impact tobacco is having on global health as well as the global economy. While it's certainly seen a decline in this country, smoking is on the rise in other parts of the world.
Well, the numbers do tell the story on this important health topic, Mark. Smoking is directly linked to some 7 million deaths per year globally. And if smoking and tobacco consumption continue at this rate, the number will be 8 million global deaths by 2030.
While smoking rates in this country have dropped significantly in the past couple of decades, one-fifth of deaths are attributed to smoking or exposure to secondhand smoke. An estimated 450,000 deaths per year in the United States. The World Health Organization is calling for a collective global action to curb the spread of tobacco, which is heavily marketed to vulnerable populations.
Well, there's an economic toll as well, Mark. The World Health Organization estimates $1.3 trillion in productivity lost from smoking-related health costs, as well as lost productivity due to sickness and absenteeism. It's exacting a huge toll on developing economies and adding hundreds of billions of dollars to healthcare costs all the way around. Terrible.
And there are some public interventions that seem to be working. Public smoking bans, higher taxes on tobacco products are helping to curb the problem, but a much larger global effort is needed. And speaking of health costs, Margaret, it's all at the center of health policy discussions underway in Washington.
The Senate is now grappling with the GOP health reform measure passed in the House to replace Obamacare. The American Health Care Act has taken a lot of heat from entities across the healthcare spectrum, and that is something our guest today has spent much of his career focused on.
Thomas Miller, a senior fellow at the Conservative American Heritage Institute, has done much research on market-based alternatives to the Affordable Care Act. He has some insights into what may happen with the Senate's iteration of the GOP health reform bill. It'll be interesting to hear what he has to say about some of those market-driven alternatives to the Affordable Care Act.
And Lori Robertson stops by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Thomas Miller in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. July at the latest. That's the timeline some Senate Republican insiders are putting on producing a replacement to the House GOP's American Health Care Act on the books. Back from Memorial Day recess, many, including GOP leadership, went home over the holiday to some vociferous opposition to their plans to repeal and replace Obamacare. Growing contingents within the GOP majority say they will not put their stamp on a bill that kicks tens of millions of Americans off their health insurance, as the Congressional Budget Office estimates might happen. With no apparent health care deal in immediate sight, some in the Senate are looking at ways they might be able to make short-term solutions and improvements to the law to bolster the unstable insurance marketplaces. Opioid death rates appear to have skyrocketed in 2016, with some early statistics revealing death rates above the 50,000 mark last year. As the epidemic continues to unfold, some state and local governments are taking their own action. Ohio, a hotspot for opioid overdoses, has become the largest state to sue Purdue Pharma, Johnson & Johnson's Janssen Pharmaceuticals Unit, Endo International, Teva Pharmaceutical, and Allergan. The lawsuit seeks to recover money the state and residents spent on unnecessary opioid prescriptions, as well as costs associated with addiction treatment. The five companies are denying allegations. The White House is following through on a promise to roll back birth control coverage requirements in the Affordable Care Act under certain circumstances. Federal officials drafting a rule that would roll back the requirement that religious organizations must comply with a mandatory birth control coverage. The proposed rule could take effect immediately as an interim final rule. The typical process, however, is to open the rule to public comments before a final decision is made. It's being called a first in clinical cancer trials, an experimental gene therapy therapy for patients with advanced multiple myeloma, a particular kind of blood cancer that is on the rise. Shows all participants in a study showed noted improvement after the experimental treatment, though the sample was relatively small, just 35 patients. Every single one responded favorably to the treatment, and all but two were in remission within 2 months. Experts say it's a first for multiple myeloma and rare for any cancer treatment to have such early success. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Thomas P. Miller, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies health policy and market-based alternatives to the Affordable Care Act. Mr. Miller is a former senior health economist for the Joint Economic Committee in Congress, where his focus was private health markets, health information transparency, and market-driven healthcare. Also served on the National Advisory Council at the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. He earned his BA in political science from NYU, his JD from Duke University School of Law. Tom, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Pleasure to be with you.
You know, you've been a vocal critic of the Affordable Care Act, but you also warned opponents of the ACA to get to work on replacement. And here we are 4 years later, watching the GOP replacement for Obamacare, the American Healthcare Act, take shape. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners what you think the current version of the law and what's really going to happen and is going on behind the scenes.
The Affordable Care Act put in place a set of benefits to people, and they don't want to let go of them. The AHCA is a reaction to that overreach. Now, the problem with moving from criticizing what's in place to replacing it has begun to confront the difficulties of Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
They may have been a little surprised at the majorities they got after the November 2016 elections, including the White House. And, you know, the old saying in professional sports is you play like you practice. They didn't practice enough, and so they weren't ready on day one to have a fully fleshed out legislative vehicle. So there's been a turnaround in attitudes where people are reacting more to what they're concerned about, disrupting what they already know, and the unknowns ahead of this various types of replacement legislation. Moving over to the Senate after some of the difficulties in the House involves changing what was done in the House to some degree, mostly reactions of senators to make the rollbacks in the Medicaid expansion coverage less onerous. There's also a reaction that moving to the type of subsidies the Republicans have advocated for health insurance, moving them from being so income sensitive to being a little bit flatter with some age adjustments, maybe too much of a stretch too quickly. And then there's just the normal problems of working through what's called budget reconciliation, which allows you to do some things but not everything. And it's difficult for the Senate to figure out where they're going to get 50 Republican votes plus the vice president. But that's what they're committed to as they stare into the deep dark abyss of the alternative being total failure.
Tom, we've had a number of guests on the show recently who've shared their thoughts about how best to retool American health care and American health reform specifically with a more market-based and consumer-driven focus. We'd really love for you to share with us what you see as the essential hallmarks of this approach, the market-based, consumer-driven focus.
Sure. We need to readjust our rhetoric and what we promise on consumer-driven care to what we can actually put in place and the speed at which it goes about. We need a better array of usable and actionable information, and we've fallen short on that, although we've made some progress on that front. You have to change the incentive structure so that people are rewarded for making better decisions and have a few negative incentives to make the wrong ones, and that works on both the provider side, the payer side, and the patient side. And that means a type of bilateral accountability. It's not a one-way directional, but you're responsible for the decisions and choices you make. We found out that there are people who actually are more involved in decision-making are not only better patients, but end up with better health. You need to also unbundle a lot of our complex integrated benefits that are supposedly one-size-fits-all and serves everyone, but don't actually match the needs and the preferences and the uniquenesses. We learn more about how all patients are very different. Safety nets are going to matter, though. If you're going to turn people loose to make more decisions, not everyone is going to want to do that. But also, a lot of people will fall through the cracks and need special help. And if you don't invest there, mm-hmm. you don't have the political support or the credibility mm-hmm. to offer wider choices and more responsibilities to everyone else in a freer environment. But the language here gets a little overstated. You know, saying everybody is going to have the most wonderful care possible at the lowest cost overstates it. What we can try to credibly promise is that people can improve their situation if they're willing to make some decisions and take some choices on their own. You can't promise the best to everyone at all times with no cost whatsoever. That's simply a political exercise which defies the reality of what actually happens. You want to try to have people, for however much they want to spend of their own money as well as what they can get from other people, to maximize their value. That's not the same thing as saying just go away and we hopefully it will cost less.
You know, it's not a muscle that Americans have exercised much in this sort of very complex, disjointed American health system. It's not like it doesn't seem to operate like the auto industry, and where consumers are really price sensitive and aware of that. You know, when you go into the emergency room, there's a real lack of transparency about what the price is, and I'm not sure you're thinking about it at that moment. But and I'm wondering what you're getting to a market driven health system is going to work through the issues of this institutional resistance to get information about pricing out there so consumers can make some choice. And what's your sense of how that's going to work in your ideal vision?
Well, we all resist accountability and transparency if we're on the other end of it. And certainly, although there have been little efforts to try to have, you know, the equivalent of menu boards of the itemized prices, that doesn't mean much to people in terms of the decisions they need to make. You want to know, what are my all-in costs going to be when I go to start over here, but what's my diagnosis and what's it going to produce when everybody throws the bills down and everybody gets involved in the multiple stages of care. Now, certainly there are extreme circumstances where you're totally unconscious of life-saving measures and you're not about to be an active decision maker. But you can plan for a whole lot more. I mean, you know right away in terms of the insurance that you choose, if you pay more attention to it, who's in your provider directory, and what you know about what that plan offers in, as a general rule. If you invest a little bit more, you might know that some doctors are better at some things than other things. Now, we can improve those tools, but those are real decisions. Also, people are not usually in, you know, life or death instantaneous situations. Even people with chronic illnesses become much more knowledgeable about their health condition and their care. So we need to deepen the channels through which people can find out more about what matters to them and be able to make better, more meaningful choices along the way. It's not an all or nothing situation. Additionally, we need to think about ways to enlist caregivers and other type of intermediary resources where other people can take care of those who can't manage things for themselves. We need to invest more in that than sometimes the benefits themselves. So the more that we get people having more interest in their health would improve what would be a true market-driven approach.
Tom, you wrote recently that in addition to the rollback of government regulations, getting rid of the individual mandate requiring the purchase of insurance, whatever version of the new health care or Trump care, if you want to call it that, we end up with needs to significantly slow the growth of Medicaid moving forward. And certainly that advice would seem to have been heeded in the ACHA, which makes dramatic cuts to Medicaid, as does the president's budget. You know, we certainly think of the safety net in terms of community health centers, which is the system of care that we're so familiar with. So what does that safety net look like if Medicaid is significantly reduced and if the patients with pre-existing conditions choose to go uninsured?
On the safety net, there are really kind of two types of populations. We sometimes blur them together. There are individuals who have short-term financial emergencies or lower income in general, and they may need some ways to get out of that low-income problem. On the other hand, when we overinvest in that side of the safety net, such as through the Medicaid expansion, we tend to give shorter shrift to the people who have much more serious longer-term illnesses or disabilities and don't treat them as well. So we need to invest more in the people who truly can't help themselves on a longer-term basis, while trying to mainstream the other low-income population into better jobs as opposed to making their status on a longer-term basis. You mentioned community health centers who tend to do a much better job for the dollar because they tend to be more accessible, less complex, less expensive as a general rule, but can actually deliver the care that people need in many of those circumstances. In addition, though, there are just many other ways in which we can improve the health of the vulnerable population, the low-income population, and that may involve ways in which by investing earlier in their lives and giving them the tools to build the skills they need, the educational factors, that they won't have those type of problems they're going to face, or they can better manage their lives in the healthcare and economic system. So if we could invest earlier in delaying the onset of these chronic conditions, there's plenty of research on that front. It's sometimes wrapped up in the idea of social determinants of health. We can actually get better health over a longer period of time and make our expensive system have fewer customers coming into it, at least at an earlier stage.
We're speaking today with Thomas P. Miller, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies health policy and market-based alternatives to the Affordable Care Act. And Tom, you know, I'd like to take a look at the national discussion that's going around health reform now, and what we're seeing now is a deeply divided public perception about the bill that came out of the House. I'm wondering how the Senate sort of builds public trust, or what's your view of the polling data right now, which did show when the Affordable Care Act was not liked, that they were pretty accurate in that. Again, it's showing that they've got off to a bad start. And so what's your thought about how do you think they'll be able to close that divide in terms of public perception?
Well, it's a serious case of risk aversion. There were some overpromises as well, or contradictory promises that came out more from President Trump. I think it's hard to regenerate some type of even non-extreme bipartisan comity. We've just got a long history as to where we've been on health care, and you're not going to put that egg back together, at least in the short term. That's why the Republicans are going it alone in the same way that the Democrats. And that's just the underlying political reality. With the narrow margins they have, it also means they go through some contorted exercises to use the tools they have to deliver something, although they didn't know what that was going to be. Looking ahead, we're likely to see some desperate moves later on toward the end of this year, early next year, to move more toward a broader short-term set of intermediate fixes and rescue efforts, particularly as some of these markets begin melting down. That's just bailing water out of the boat, but we will eventually go through that exercise if necessary. I'd like to be more optimistic on this front, but I tend to adopt the perspective of Miracle Max in The Princess Bride. I've seen worse, but it's mostly dead.
Well, I'm going to give you a chance to be a little bit optimistic, perhaps, because one of the tenets we live by is we should always be looking around the country to see who's doing innovative work, who's not just had a good idea, but is implementing it, innovating, and has some results to show for it. So when you look around the country, what states do you see that have really made some positive strides in health reform? We'd love to hear your take on that.
Look, states have been, their things happen to small degrees. You can pull out particular efforts, whether they're, you know, managed care and Medicaid, or small pockets of individual provider groups trying to do things differently and having something. We tend to know about the excellent examples. The problem is how to broad-base them and scale them up. And they tend to have a certain organic nature to it. The same people who were good before are good again. That doesn't necessarily give you the answer to it. With the Affordable Care Act, we increasingly treated the states as the equivalent of like a large employer, self-funded plan. They're for administrative services only. But we also stunted what might have been the more evolutionary bottom-up development of things working and other people saying, hey, that works, and you get rewarded if you do it, so let's do more of it, because we put things into a little bit more of a cookie-cutter arrangement. And so we overuse the word innovation. I don't want innovation. I want something that works. And if something that works well, it should work on a larger scale, and more people should do it. So it needs to be tested by what results are actually produced. If we get into a more results-oriented approach, which doesn't measure whether you've hit the check marks in the various set of potential healthcare inputs by that measurement, but actually produces better life expectancy or less upsetting consequences to your injuries and improves your health, that's what I want to know about. I also want to know how much it costs. And that's a balancing act between the cost and the outcome side as to which setting you prefer, and they call that value.
We've been speaking today with Thomas P. Miller, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies health policy and market-based alternatives to the Affordable Care Act. You can learn more about his work by going to aei.org. Tom, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
You're very welcome.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Learn Terry Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Our readers have asked us whether scientists have confirmed that e-cigarettes cause an incurable respiratory disease called popcorn lung. The answer is no. The vapor of some e-cigarettes contains a chemical associated with popcorn lung, but there's not enough evidence to conclude they cause the disease. Electronic cigarettes, or e-cigarettes, were introduced into the U.S. market in 2007. They deliver nicotine, flavorings, and other chemicals to users in the form of a vapor, and they're often promoted as safer than traditional cigarettes. Online articles on e-cigarettes and popcorn lung have been circulating on social media. Popcorn lung, or bronchiolitis obliterans, is an incurable disease characterized by the scarring of the smallest airways in the lung. That scarring limits the passage of air. If the disease becomes severe enough, the only treatment option may be a lung transplant. Researchers have associated the inhalation of popcorn flavoring chemicals with popcorn lung in workers at microwave popcorn factories. A December 2015 study conducted by scientists at the Harvard School of Public Health found at least one of three chemicals associated with popcorn lung in 47 of the 51 e-cigarette vapors studied. But the study didn't confirm that e-cigarettes definitely cause popcorn lung. Previous research on exposure to diacetyl suggests it might not be that chemical alone that can cause respiratory issues. While it's unclear whether e-cigarettes can cause popcorn lung, what is certain is that they aren't harmless. They contain nicotine, which poses health risks, especially to children and teens. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Fitness trackers have become all the rage, especially among upwardly mobile, fitness-conscious people seeking to monitor their own health and fitness goals. But another trend has emerged in the age of wearable devices. After a few months, about a third of users simply stop using them, leaving a lot of costly devices sitting on the shelf and not in use. The reality captured the imagination of Tufts University School of Medicine professor Dr. Lisa Gualtieri.
And I thought, what if you could take all of these abandoned trackers and give them to the people who could benefit most from them?
So in 2015, she launched her nonprofit enterprise, Recycle Health, an online social media campaign which seeks donated wearable devices to provide these expensive devices for free to those in need.
People are excited about the potential of these devices to help them lead healthier lives. At the same time, there are many, many barriers. So we found a lot of people who never downloaded an app to their smartphone. So how do you get the package, get the device working on your wrist?
She partnered with organizations working with adults in wellness programs, seniors in fall prevention programs, and veterans as well. Her goal is to start collecting vital data on the deployment of these devices and the impact they may be having on behavior change in vulnerable populations.
One of our dreams would be to make it really easy for organizations that have money. So, for instance, insurers to say, the money that we spend on giving people trackers is going to save us so much more than that in reduced healthcare costs. We're working with a number of senior centers in the greater Boston area. We really see a lot of potential with populations who are not the ones that the vendors are targeting.
She's hoping to expand their data collection on health outcomes for vulnerable populations who gain access to these wearables.
These are devices that people weren't using, people no longer want, and other people are being helped by it. It's about as low cost an intervention as you could possibly have.
Recycle Health, a simple repurposing of personalized wearables, providing these tools to vulnerable populations, empowering them to engage in activities that can improve their own health. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.